You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
Soprano Deborah Voigt, soprano Christine Brewer, stage director Paul Curran, and conductor Sir Andrew Davis are backstage at Lyric.
For such a serious opera, there's a lot of riotous behavior going on stage. And Paul has been very good about keeping his puppies, as he described. What is it like to be a director? And he told us that it's like directing puppies. But I'm going to tell your own story, that you look down at a basket and they're all there so eager to please you. And then you turn around for 2 minutes and one's in the corner taking a leak and one's over here doing this. And it's absolutely been like that for him. He'll be talking to one of us and he'll turn around and say, usually it's Franz.
Yeah.
Franz! And he's off somewhere. But it's been a tremendous amount of fun.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the Lyric Opera Discovery Series session for Richard Strauss's Die Frau ohne Schatten, The Woman Without a Shadow. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and opera experts. We do one session per opera. They usually take place a few days prior to opening night of the production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with great artists. Check out our website at www.lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We're including all of the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. And now, on to the Discovery Series panel featuring Deborah Voigt, Christine Brewer, Paul Curran, and Sir Andrew Davis. I'm your host for this session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Now, since Frau has not been done at Lyric in 23 years, I had better refresh everyone's memories about this story. So here we go, 60-second version, see how I do. In a mythical land, the emperor rules with his empress, daughter of Kaikobad, the spirit king. Kaikobad's messenger brings the empress's nurse a message. If the empress fails to procure a shadow, that is, conceive a child, in 3 days, the emperor will be turned to stone. While the emperor is on a 3-day hunting expedition, the nurse, at her suggestion, accompanies the empress to the human world to find a woman who will sell her shadow to the empress. They find the restless and unhappy wife of Barak the Dire. The wife no longer has any desire for children, although her husband still wants them. The nurse tempts the wife with visions of wealth and love, which will be hers if she yields her shadow. The wife denies their husband their marriage bed for 3 days, during which the nurse and the empress are their servants. After much emotional agony, the empress realizes that the cost to other human beings in gaining another's shadow is too high. Her innate goodness earns her a shadow, restores her husband to life, and brings the reconciliation of Barak and his wife. The opera ends with both couples ecstatically proclaiming their wish to contribute to the continuation of humanity through children.
Is that all right? All basically, yeah. Thanks.
Close enough.
I think it's wonderful when we have such extensive correspondence between a composer and librettist as we have between Strauss and Hofmannsthal, and I recommend the correspondence to all of you. It's as fascinating as any novel. So, Paul, what do we learn from those letters between Strauss and Hofmannsthal about how this work came about?
You sort of learned that it was basically like Rodgers and Hammerstein. There was very little difference because they argued constantly. It wasn't like a happy, oh, let's do a really happy, great opera. No, it was constant letters between each other saying too many words. How can I fit this to the music? One of the most famous bits of correspondence were over the scene changes, where Hofmannsthal is writing, saying, well, you need to give me an exact time for these scene changes. We can't have all this music and nobody singing. I mean, you just need to get on with it. And Strauss writes back saying, I think it's quite adequate, blah, blah. So you learn a lot that actually it was a correspondence that led to a great, not conflict, but a great sort of what I would call a productive argument. that made it work. But they did that throughout all of their works. The main thing that they didn't do, they refused to do, was finish the work while the war was still going on. Because they said, both of them agreed, and it's very, very clear in the correspondence that they couldn't write a piece about the continuation of humankind while there was such a horrific war taking place.
Did Strauss have an interesting attitude about the dramatic content of this piece? It certainly wasn't typical for him, really.
Well, it wasn't really that typical, but it always, I think, with Strauss, and we've talked about this a lot with the ladies, it always goes back, I think, to the same thing, which is he goes back to women's stories. It keeps turning into this sort of story of two women, or both sides of the one woman. But it's by far the most, other than Egyptian Helen, which I know both ladies have done, it's probably the most exotic of all the Strauss works.
Now, you've got these two central female characters, the Empress and the Dyer's Wife, and they are so rewarding to sing and to act. It's always the women who are the most rewarding people to portray in Strauss. So I wanted to ask all of you, the ladies especially, have you ever wondered what it was in Strauss that gave him such an amazing understanding of feminine psychology?
Well, I would have wondered about it, but I'm sure Paul can answer it more effectively than me.
Well, when I sing Salome, I know it's very different from me, David. Yeah. I feel my inner woman coming right through.
It's always so much fun to see that happen.
Does he speak to 21st century women, do you think? Is there still so much in these women that we really can relate to?
Oh, I think absolutely, so. Yes.
I think so. Certainly. I mean, I maybe not at the very... Am I supposed to talk right into this?
No.
Maybe not right at the very end when the Dyer's Wife finally, you know, says she'll have children and serve her husband and all of that, you know. Maybe not 21st century, but, you know.
Well, of course, Strauss himself had an extraordinary wife who was a soprano. And who gave him a pretty rough time one way. I mean,
very
he
rough.
Absolutely adored her, but it was a very tempestuous relationship. And she used to really do things like, you know, if he had a piece that he had a deadline for, she would sort of lock him in his study and say, no lunch until you write another 28 pages, you know. actually, I once met some people who had every year gone to the same place in Switzerland on holiday in the summer, when the Strausses always went there, and they became friendly with them. And Strauss died in 1949, and so Paulina was there by herself the next summer. And then the summer after that, she died because she died within a year of her husband. And these two said to each other, "You see, even up there, if she wouldn't give him a minute's peace." But it was an incredibly productive relationship. I mean, you know, the famous tone poem Ein Heldenleben has, of course, a huge solo violin part which portrays Christine. And the solo violin part is full of descriptive adjectives, you know, scolding, angry, seductive, you know, so that this is a very complicated woman, and I think that's one of the reasons why his female characters are always so interesting and so deep and so sometimes contradictory. And of course, he wrote a whole opera based on an incident when she found in his pocket a note from some lady that, and there was a big argument about this, so he wrote this opera intermezzo to sort of justify this whole thing. It was very mad. Which is a marvelous piece, actually.
She also created the leading soprano role in the first opera he ever wrote, Guntram, and supposedly she was making an incredible scene and being really just furious about what the orchestra was doing, just nothing was right, and screaming. And so he went into her dressing room, closed the door, and then there was all of this commotion that they heard, and then he opened the door and announced to everyone that they were engaged. So, Christine and Debbie, were there specific portions of the music that convinced you that you really needed to sing these roles, the Empress and the Dyer's Wife? And if so, what attracted you the most in the score?
Well, it's absolutely glorious music. There's no getting around it. It's very difficult, I find, especially for the Kaiserin. Well, it's the only one I sing so far. But the requirements vocally are almost for two different voice types. entirely, a much more lyric voice at the onset of the opera and then much more dramatic towards the end. And so, of course, vocally, from a technical perspective, it was a challenge and something that I certainly wanted to tackle. But she's such an interesting character and makes such an enormous journey from the moment that we see her sort of naive and rolling out of bed with the Kaiser to where she goes in the end. And I find as my career goes along that those sort of characters are the ones that engage me the most, and the kind of one-dimensional characters. For example, I just sang my first Maddalena in André Chénier, and, you know, pretty music, but not a well-rounded sort of character, and that just doesn't sort of ignite a fire in me anymore. And so certainly the Kaiserin does that.
Christine, was it the dramatic content or was it the music that got you first?
It was actually both. I agree with Debbie on this, that it's a lot more fun to sing these sort of three-dimensional, strong sort of women. And so it was both. I mean, it is certainly difficult sing, too. Mm-hmm. but she goes through such a journey. She's going through a journey as well. And it's interesting to see where she and the Kaiserin come up in the third act then. You know, they've both made this journey through the whole night.
Right. Andrew, Frau is really one of the most demanding operas in your repertoire. Was conducting Salome last season good preparation for this piece, do you think?
Well, I've conducted a lot of Strauss, as you know, over the years, in various places. A lot of Glyndebourne, but of course the smaller things there, Capriccio and Arabella, and but I've done Elektra and Salome several times. Frau is something different. It's on a massive scale. The whole structure of the piece is immense, in a way that and keeping the whole. The flow of the music and the sense of direction is very important in it. It also is a huge orchestra. It's a bigger orchestra than The Ring. I mean, it has Wagner tubas the way The Ring does. It has more clarinets than the Ring, and it has, of course, a lot of percussion. It also has two celestas, which is very unusual. It's the only piece I know that actually has two celestas in it. And the other instrument that features in the piece that's usually omitted is the glass harmonica, which some of you may know was an instrument invented by Benjamin Franklin and is a sort of apotheosis of the, you know, the rubbing the wine glass. And it's actually sort of rotating glass discs that are, and the player has a sort of trough of water than he plays them. Well, there are very few of these around and even few people to play them. So, you know, I'd thought that we would, like sort of everybody else, leave the part out, which is a pity. But then, of course, this is a wonderful technological age, so we actually, one of the percussion players managed to find a sample of the instrument, and so it's being played on a synthesizer with remarkable fidelity of the actual sound. And it doesn't appear till the third act, after the Empress does her renunciation of the shadow, and this eerie sound begins, and then it sort of permeates the texture of the orchestra for the rest of the piece and gives this sort of otherworldly sense that's quite remarkable.
Right?
In fact, the only other composer to have written, of any note to have written for the glass harmonica, was Mozart. And, of course, it was very new then. He wrote several pieces for the glass harmonica.
There's also a famous use of it in the mad scene from Lucia.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes. That's the other thing.
Yeah. So when should people listen to it? Is it after you say, Ich will nicht, when
this
sound?
I have no idea. I didn't even know. Andrew, why did you tell me about that? It's my sixth production of Fraunishan. I didn't even know there was such a thing.
Well, I'll wink at you when it plays on Friday.
Yes, Lord knows neither of us will have anything else to do with that.
So beyond just the sheer scale of it, are there particular passages that are really sort of virtuosic for the orchestra where you really...
Well, all of Strauss operas have passages that are extremely virtuosic for the orchestra. I mean, he has the violin, well, the whole string section leaping around in one of a very loud passage in the last act, frankly, you can't hear a note of it. But it's very exciting to watch in the pit, but... because, you know, the brass is going strong and the percussion and, you know, the kitchen sink and an organ. And so Yes. It's but there are moments of great delicacy too, and one of the greatest of all still moments in any work that I know of is that wonderful scene for the Empress in the last act with a just incredibly beautiful violin solo, and it's a some kind of oasis of calm in what's quite until the third act generally a rather frenetic work, I would say, musically.
Debbie, this is your sixth production. Is there a difference between the Empress that you're playing in this production versus the kind of Empress that you've been asked to play before?
Well, I think that the role matures along with the singer. So you always come to it with new sorts of input, having had different experiences in one's life. But I think in this particular production, Paul has had Christine and I really play up the relationship between the two women and the sort of discovery of this human being, and she has no idea what this person is or who she is or what. And you see that happening, I think, more so, absolutely more so in this production than any of the others that I've done. And it's been a lot of fun because we've had an enormous amount of fun in rehearsals. For such a serious opera, there's a lot of riotous behavior going on stage. And Paul has been very good about keeping his puppies, as he described. What is it like to be a director? And he told us that it's like directing puppies. But I'm going to tell your own story, that you look down at a basket and they're all there so eager to please you. And then you turn around for 2 minutes and one's in the corner taking a leak and one's over here doing this. And it's absolutely been like that for him. He'll be talking to one of us and he'll turn around and say, usually it's Franz.
Yeah.
Franz. And he's off somewhere. But it's been a tremendous amount of fun.
The production that you premiered at the Met was sort of contemporary as the wasn't it, the look of it?
Yes,
And does that mean that the Empress was somebody who belonged in like the 1950s or something like that?
No,
it wasn't quite
no,
that.
I certainly didn't play her that way.
Oh, okay.
No. Actually, but you have to be honest about that production. The thing I was most concerned about was just not falling on the set.
Oh.
That was my primary goal. It was an absolutely beautiful scene.
Very big and shiny. Wasn't
big and
it?
Shiny. Yes. It was all mirrors. The floor, which was lovely, except that if you happened to step on your gown, you took a nosedive. We had to wear special shoes with rubber soles. And then we discovered that when we would walk from the stage to our dressing room, we were picking up dust, and so we would slip again. So every time we came off stage, we would sit down and put our feet in the air, and the dressers would run up with little booties and put booties on our feet to protect our shoes. So not that that was the most striking thing about their production, but...
What? Getting back to the character, what sort of backstory do you imagine for her, her life pre-Emperor and during the year that she's been married to the Emperor?
I sort of think of her as just sort of a typical sort of what we imagine a princess type of person to be. Everything is for her will, for her whim, and I don't think she's really thought much about anything beyond that until we actually meet her. And then she kicks in and we start to see things come to life in her. And what is so important about the part, there's not a lot of singing for her in the first couple of acts. There's an enormous dream scene, of course, in the second act. But much of her development is just through the audience's observation of the character. And of the six productions that I've done, I've been fortunate enough to be in the original cast of five of them. And the sixth one, not this one, but prior, I stepped into somebody else's interpretation of the role. And this person must not have had a strong opinion about it and of course, constantly being concerned about whether you're casting a shadow or not. I was constantly told to stay in the back of the stage in the dark. And it really doesn't work because you don't see the Kaiserin observing what's going on, not only with the Fairburn, but also with Barak. That relationship is really very important in terms of where she goes. And so I think that's probably one of the most important parts.
But you really do spend tons of time the first two acts listening.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Christine, you've played some pretty strong-willed, nobly born ladies like Iphigenie and Isolde and Queen Elizabeth I. So how does it feel to be playing a housewife on the stage after all that?
Okay, now, I still think she's a very strong character. much like Queen Elizabeth I. She is. Okay, don't give me that look, Paul.
I didn't see the words.
The dresses aren't as nice, though.
The dresses aren't as nice. That's true. The dresses are more Cinderella-ish. But she is a very complex, difficult, fierce person. And quite often, you know, we come away from this and just say, oh, she's a shrew, she's a bitch, she's, you know. And we had this discussion one day in one of the rehearsals. And I think Mr. Curran said something about the dyer's wife was just really bitchy or something. I don't know. Those were the exact words. And I don't know, it just set off something in me, and I said, well, you know what? She's really misunderstood. Why wouldn't she be this way? She's saddled with this, you know, these three handicapped brothers-in-law, and working, you know, and taking care of business, taking care of her husband and these brothers, and his question is always, why don't you want to have children? I mean, come on!
I always wonder what it must smell like in a dyer's house,
yeah,
you know?
Right!
Well, actually, in the middle of all of this, as she was not ranting and raging at quite this speed. It was so high, only dogs could hear it for a start. And we all just stood back, and at the end of it, I said, that would kind of be my point. She rants, rages, screams like a bitch, and nobody understands her. So let's just get on with the scene, Miss Brewer. Take two. So I think we found her.
She became the Fairbairn that day.
I did. Yeah, you're right.
Actually, one of the things we put in, we discussed a lot with Christine, we put into this production, is there are several moments within it where actually I've got Christine standing just staring at Barak, looking at him, because I think she loves him enormously. And I thought it was important when Barak at one point is working, she's just standing looking at him. And it's up to you to think, does she love him, does she hate him, whatever. But in order to see any problem, you have to see what it is that attracts her to this man and what takes her to that man finally at the end. Otherwise, she'd go to a divorce court and it'd all be over and there'd be no problem. But she does actually want him. Whatever she says in that third act duet is she is absolutely desperate for this man to come back into her life. So I thought it was important that we established that much more clearly. Also in... I can't remember what bloody scene it is, one of the millions of scenes of this opera. At one point, we have them sitting together when she's saying, it's up to you, you need to sort this out. And it was quite a difficult thing to rehearse because the timing is, as she looks away, he goes to look at her, but he misinterprets what she's doing. She's just looking away. He interprets it as, I'm not interested in discussing this. As he looks away, she looks back to go and say something. And of course, she's saying, oh, well, bugger you, that's the end of that. Can't go on with it. So I think it's a situation every one of us know from our own marriages. But it was an important part to show that she was not just a shrew and a horrid creature.
That's right.
Getting back to the orchestra for a minute, Andrew, is the orchestra as much a commentator on the action as they would be in Wagner? I mean, there are some leitmotifs that are running through
there. Yes, well, in that sense, it's the most Wagnerian of all his operas, and partly because it's mythical, you know, which is the kind of world that Wagner moves in. So from the very beginning, we have this motif which is associated with Kaikobad, who is this sort of superior being, rather terrifying, mysterious, dark world that he seems to represent.
Oh, God, it's almost, when you read a lot about Strauss, it's sort of like this whole thing of him being so bothered by his Catholicism and the sort of guilt trip that if you grew up a Catholic, as I did, that Catholicism can bring, or any sort of deeply steeped religion of that nature. And it comes through all the way through the piece. What we were talking about earlier in the third act, I think, is just an enormous contrast musically between this very hard, masculine world of Kaikobad and the darkness and ugliness of it, and this beautiful feminine music that comes out that's the Empress's music. So it's a real world of these leitmotifs, a real world of contrast that I think take you into the fantasy of the piece most easily.
And the fact that the Wagner tubas, for instance, I mean, the opening of the third act is this very solemn motif we've heard several times before, but somehow it acquires some new significance, I think, and sets up the kind of solemnity of the third act, which is one of the remote. I mean, I adore the third act. It's very slow moving and at times static compared to the earlier acts, but it has a sort of luminosity and simply a great beauty that takes your breath away.
Andrew, Debbie, and Christine, there are some pretty lengthy operas in all of your repertoires, one of which is Frau. So, I mean, you both sing Isolde, for example. How do you feel after a Frau versus how you feel after an Isolde?
I think Isolde's more tiring.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because, she's on the stage for the whole first act and the whole second act, and it's almost nonstop singing. Well, not much, but I mean, it's that I think takes more, and this sort of paces it. I mean, the second act is the most difficult for the Dyer's Wife, the most dramatic and the most singing. But even in that act, the scenes are split up in a way that you do get 5 or 10 minutes to sort of decompress and then go again. You know, it's sort of like running a relay or something, as opposed to a marathon, which would be more of Isolde, I think.
In the scenes where the Empress is not singing that much and is observing, I mean, that also takes a certain kind of energy and concentration, doesn't it?
Well, you can't ever really drop your body. An audience can see that, and they can read what's going on from your back. And I find that I'm pretty tired after this one. And also the set is not raked. Hallelujah.
Thank you. Thank you.
However, it is still a bit treacherous. Not the scenes in my world. Thankfully, they're flat and wonderful. But the Dyer's
the
house.
In the hut.
Yeah. It's a lot of different levels with just maybe an
the
inch
pots
apart.
And
you have to be very careful and very sure-footed. And we were really fortunate enough to have the set from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. And that makes an enormous difference. But opera singing is very physical. And it requires an enormous amount of energy. That being said, I think Zalome was worse. that was much more exhausting. And I'm fortunate enough to be doing that same production in another theater in the United States in a little over a year. And I'm already thinking, oh gosh, 4 months ahead of time, it's back to the gym.
Well, Andrew, what about you as far as maintaining the stamina through these three long acts?
Well, for me, the acts get slightly easier as they get along. Musically, the first act is very complicated. The second act is the most complicated from a staging point of view. But there is some really tricky stuff. And a lot of the music for the nurse, for the Amme, is very swift and complex and has to be very carefully balanced. There are always problems of balance in Strauss, except for the most part, if the orchestra really observes the dynamics faithfully, the voices come through. And in fact, I've been very surprised with the music staff have been in orchestra rehearsals, station orchestra rehearsals, and actually have had very few notes about balance issues for me, which is very gratifying. But he was very smart. So even if the orchestra suddenly it plays something very loud, and then all of a sudden they'll come right down for a vocal phrase. The danger is if the orchestra doesn't do that, then you get into a big mess. And
but we also put that into the design.
Yes.
Yeah, into the design. Kevin Knight, the set and costume designer, we absolutely don't think it was an accident. It was not an accident. I've had too many singers over the past 15 years complaining about bad sets. So the compromise for the ladies, nimbly, beautifully, you'll admit, running over the set, is that there's a wall and everything's hard. Everything on it reflects sound. And what the wall does is it sort of acts like a loudspeaker. It reflects the sound straight out. And we were actually very, very aware with such an enormous orchestra. And, you know, these ladies have pretty big voices, but still, there's a lot of orchestra going on at the time. But we were very aware, in consultation with Andrew, that we needed something that was going to push the sound forward and push it out. Otherwise, then there really are problems and they all need to come down the front.
there's no standard way to present this piece on the stage, and productions of Frau have gone in any number of different directions. So, Paul, when you knew this piece was in your future, how did you begin thinking about what it could look like, and what direction did you finally decide to go in with it?
I answered that earlier. Sheer unadulterated terror. Kevin and I have been working together. We're coming up to our 20th production. We're thinking of doing a book. like a 20-year marriage. But when we got the piece, we've both done Strauss operas before. We've done Ariadne about 5 times, and we've done Daphne. Available in DVD, help yourselves. So we'd done a lot of Strauss before, and I love Strauss. So I knew, number one, that the biggest influence in the piece for me would be the music. So visually, I was looking for a world that depicted something that I was visualizing musically. It's a very dark world, so we went with that area, and also the Dyer's hut. We went to this thing. We actually got all this reference together from India and from Pakistan, where these people had all these pots, and they're all in different levels, and they actually dye stuff exactly as you see it on the stage here. So what we wanted were all these colours all around the place, and we sort of wanted, it was a little bit like with Christine's character, we kept saying, she should be, if he's a dyer and she's a dyer, they should be surrounded by colour, but yet there's no colour in her life, nothing. Like Mimi in La Bohème, Mimi says, I sew, embroider flowers all day, but they don't actually smell. So it was the same sort of analogy for us with what the dyer's hut would be, which was by far the biggest problem to solve. And then we thought, out of that, how do you get these slaves and all the colour that comes out that the Empress and the Amma present? So we decided that out of the colour would come bits of, a lot of silk. Because it's very simple technology at the Lyric Opera.
You have also an enormous challenge that this is a through composed piece, so you've got transitions that you have to deal with going from one scene to the other. What, 5 scenes in Act 2 and 4 in Act 3?
Yes.
So how were those transitions accomplished?
Kevin and I are basically Broadway babies. We sort of grew up with musical theatre and all the rest of it, and very rarely in musical theatre does the curtain come down and a scene change take place. There's either somebody out the front singing their lungs out, or you're seeing it. So I go to the theatre for a thrilling night of music, singing, and action. It all has to add up. So I would go berserk in this show if all of a sudden a big curtain came down and you hear it all thumping and banging at the back. Because I'm saying to myself, what are they doing? What's happening? I remember once seeing a show, came down, thump, bang, bang, thump, bang, bang, thump. I'm thinking, oh, fantastic, my God, this is fabulous. Curtain went out black, pitch black. What the hell were they doing? So what we did with this was we wanted to make it, because the set is so big and the stage is so big, we wanted to make it an experience of what the set changes were. And also the idea that the worlds all coexist, one and the other. So the first day we lit it and we saw that hut come around the corner was quite exciting, I must say. It was actually quite thrilling to see that.
You've also got some people who are flying. And does it take a bit of persuasion to get singers to fly?
No. Debbie and Christine fly quite easily. That's no problem. That quartet, they're all on strings. First of all, you cast people who have done it before. I used to be a dancer, so I've flown in ballets before. Yes, many years and many kilos ago, I was a dancer. So I've done flying before. And we knew we wanted something, because when you look at a stage picture, you need different dimensions within that stage picture. And we knew we needed something coming out of the sky, something that would actually join up. So the end of the second act, did you see the dress rehearsal yesterday?
Yes.
Yeah? So the end of the second act is probably the most difficult scene I've ever had to stage in my life. Strauss asked for a flood. You feel like saying, please, I'll write you a check, just cut the flood. But most productions actually ignore the flood. We decided to embrace it fully, much to our chagrin. So that involves a lot of aerialists and one big silky idea. A lot of silkworms have given their lives for this show.
But the other thing about that, there's only about 35 seconds of music for you to make the flood happen. It's a very big technical challenge.
Yes, you are asking yourself, why? It's all over. But we're there.
But you also have one of your central characters who's flying. The Emperor has to fly.
Yes. Now, that was a question right from the outset. We thought the Emperor, who's sort of mainly human, but there must be something part celestial about him, when he comes into the forest, we wanted him to fly into the forest on a magic horse, which is painted with UV paint. So right from the outset, we got in touch with Robert Dean Smith's agent and said, we want you to fly in a horse. And I thought, oh, he'll come back and say, forget it, I'm not doing any flying horses like that. And we didn't hear anything. So when we first met Bob on the first couple of days of rehearsal, I said, now this horse thing. And he said, oh, I grew up in Kansas, there's no problem with a horse. I said, oh, lovely, get in the horse. Right, we'll do it now. And I must say, he's been astonishingly brave. But I think in a piece like this, oh, the court, look, the first person to go up on the horse, the first person in the box, the first person to do any of the flying was me. Every single rehearsal, when we did it in the summer tech, I did the whole thing myself.
I don't recall seeing you as an aerialist.
Yeah. You, you girls
really
were not.
That little costume. Yeah. Ooh, baby.
You can see it's been impossible working with you. The hardest thing in this production is separating the three ladies in rehearsal. Talk about working with puppies.
Yes.
It's been fantastic. The three of them, you turn your back and they're sitting there giggling and laughing. It's been the most hilarious rehearsal period I've had in my life. Absolutely fabulous.
The third lady, by the way, is the mezzo-soprano Jill Grove, who I must say is a magnificent nurse. Christine and Debbie, you're both celebrated for Strauss, and there's several roles that both of you have in common, Ariadne, the Egyptian Helen, and Chrysotomus in Electra. So an empress, I think, is usually an Ariadne, sometimes a Marcellin, and frequently a Chrysotomus. So, Debbie, isn't the empress's music substantially more demanding than theirs?
Yes. Of those ladies, yes. I think, yes, absolutely, the empress is more demanding. Possibly, yeah, a little bit higher, a little bit lower as well. Some incredible octave jumps, I think, little over two at one point, or close to it. So yes, I think probably the Kaiserin is the most demanding.
How is the whole experience of performing Salome, which was such a success last year, has it changed at all the way you approach Strauss, or has it helped you in any of the other roles on the other Strauss?
Well, something sort of happened, I think, vocally during Salome, and I'm not really sure how to explain it, except that I think my voice maybe opened up a little bit more, or maybe it was just a matter of singing a character that absolutely demanded that I throw myself into it physically, emotionally. But it seems to have sort of opened up something in terms of the Kaiserin, and Tristan and a lot of the Germanic repertoire that I sing, which may make the opening scene of the Kaiserin a little bit more difficult, but it's been much more rewarding to go through the rest of the role. It's been sort of interesting.
The opening scene, she's almost a lyric coloratura, isn't she?
Yes, I'm considering paying the woman who's singing the Falcon to pop off a few high notes that are kind of like, oh, you know.
Christine, the other Strauss roles that you sing are they're so warm and womanly, and sympathetic, and their music goes along with that. So how does Strauss respond musically and vocally to the shrewishness, or the shrewish side, I should say, of the Dyer's wife?
Yeah. They're all afraid to say that now.
I wonder why.
I saw Andrew sort of cringing. Do you know, I have to say, whatever role I'm singing, I approach it in a very lyric way. And I don't think of myself as a dramatic soprano. I think more like a lyric soprano. And then, of course, the role, informs me then how I'm going to sing it ultimately. But I always have to approach it from a lyric standpoint to be able to sing it. And then you can add the drama and the, you know, so I don't go from it the other way, because I think it could be really dangerous vocally to do that.
I just have to throw something in here. Christine Brewer has the most remarkable marking voice. If you don't know what marking means, it's a way of preserving our voices in rehearsals. And most of us sing it down an octave or two, depending on the hour. This one rolls out of bed at 10 o'clock in the morning and sings in octave marking, pianissimi. At one point, she was rehearsing on the stage, and Jill Groves and I were I always do that. We're sitting above her, like going boom, 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 because she just
I was thinking you're keeping it in the production. It was fantastic.
You may still see it.
See, I don't know what they're doing above me on the bridge, you know. And then he said, oh, they're shooting you. Every time you hit a high note, they're shooting you.
It's meant to love, darling.
She has the last act duet where she can sing lyrically.
Yeah,
but
right.
Are there some phrases, you know, in the first two acts where she can sing lyrically?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, okay.
And I think, I mean, it's the same as when you're singing Isolde. You can't sing the whole first act in that sort of bombastic way. You have to find the places that you can be more womanly and more lyric, because not only because it preserves a voice, but it also is more interesting than if it just all becomes, oh my God, she's just screaming at us tonight, you know? Then it really would be too shrewish, I think.
Can you both talk about the balance of repertoire that you've achieved that allows you to maintain this vocal freshness that you have, even when singing some of the most strenuous roles in the entire operatic repertoire? How do you make sure that you're always singing the right thing, and you don't sing too much of one thing? How do you just keep that balance?
Well, it can be very difficult, but I think the key, at least for me, has been not to take on the extremely heavy Wagnerian repertoire too soon, because once that happens, it's going to be very difficult to go back, if not vocally, simply because that's where people are going to need you. And so at this point in my career, I find it really important to do as much Italian repertoire as I can. I also do a lot of recital singing, which allows me a chance not only to vocally show a different side of my vocal character, but also, you know, most of these ladies are not happy-go-lucky, you know, ladies. And so to have a chance to sing a little bit of cabaret or Broadway or some American song literature allows you a chance to lighten up vocally, but also lighten up in terms of personality as well.
And Christine, I know you sang with Andrew comparatively recently, the Poulain Gloria, which not every Brunhilde and Isolde will sing. So is that the kind of thing you're
talking
about?
That's the kind, exactly. And I still, you know, I started out singing lots of Mozart, and I still keep, even if I'm not performing it, I'm working on it, I'm singing it, that's the kind of stuff I do, you know, for fun. That's the stuff I take to my teacher. I've been working on Queen of the Night for fun, you know. I know. Boom, 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 boom. No, wait. Debbie.
That is the quote of the evening, I think, isn't it?
A theater near you.
No, but you know what? I think that is such a kick, because to hear that music sung with a dramatic sort of coloratura is just thrilling.
Christine, you may be getting some offers.
Yeah. I'm going to tell you, when I did Haydn Armida a few years ago, and that's what sort of got me thinking. I thought, well, you know, Queen of the Night's not that much higher than this Haydn Armida. I could probably do that. That'd be kind of fun. So I've been sort of just working on it for fun. But my husband one day, who's not a musician, was upstairs painting, and he heard me working on this. And he came downstairs, and he said, what are you singing? And I said, oh, you know, some Mozart. He said, it doesn't sound like Mozart I've heard you sing before. What Mozart? I said, oh, it's, you know, for magic flute. He said, well, what is it? And I said, okay, Queen of the Night. And he said, has someone hired you to sing this? So, anyway.
I would pay a lot of money to see that.
But the point is, that's what helps me keep my voice flexible. And I'm doing some Handel things in New York next year. And I love that, because it keeps me more interested, too. And like Debbie, I like to do cabaret things. I do a lot of recitals. And it just keeps it all fresh. You know?
I wanted to ask all of you if there is any Strauss that you haven't done yet that you hope will come your way.
Elektra.
Yeah. Marshallin, for me, I would like to do.
For me, Xylome, Elektra, and Rosencavalier. Yeah.
For me, Intermezzo, because I've done, and I think it's a most interesting and rather neglected one of part of the Strauss canon. Of course, Hofmannsthal disapproved of it heartily because Strauss actually wrote his own libretto for it, and it was in the middle of their collaboration, so it caused a little harumphing from... the other thing about Strauss and Hofmannsthal is they actually didn't spend very much time together ever. They didn't go and have working sessions, and that's why we have such great correspondence, because they spend such little time in each other's company.
I always, especially with a piece as profound as this, I always want to ask people on the panel about food for thought that they hope the audience will take away with them at the end of this piece. So if you can talk in those terms, what do you think, what do you want to stay with people from Frau?
I think it's simple. I think humanity's worth fighting for. I think that's what it's about. Really, I think it's a very long and difficult struggle, whatever our lives are. But equally, everybody that watches it or listens to it will have a different experience. And yes. I think that's absolutely vital. I've just been working in Germany, which I cannot bear working in Germany. I'm just not going back because they think there's only one answer. What must we think here, Herr Kahn? What should we be thinking? And I just remember saying to this intendant, I don't know your shopping list, anything you like. I couldn't care less. I'm not in your head. Oh, but we should be thinking something. And she said, well, what are you thinking when you're doing it? I said, well, the rehearsal went very bad, and I assure you I was thinking my shopping list. And the airport. And she's looking at me, and I said, yes, it is being flippant, because I cannot get into your head.
Thank you. That was wonderful. My silly question for the day is, I'm always curious as to what people listen to for pleasure as a change of pace from the opera that they're doing. And given that you're all immersed in this extreme, sort of heavy-duty, sort of hyper-emotional world of Strauss, what are you listening to at home? Or do you unwind by not listening to music at all?
I do listen to music, and I don't listen to opera. I listen to Bruce Springsteen. I listen to Dolly Parton. I listen to Lynn Harrell playing the cello. I have a lot of different things, but it's sometimes just quiet also is good. Just quiet time.
Well, I recently went to a John Mayer and Sheryl Crow concert.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've been kind of listening to them. And Michael Bublé is another one that I like very much.
Mm-hmm. The Scissor Sisters, Drowsy Chaperone, Dean Martin, a lot of Dean Martin.
Oh, I like Dean Martin, too.
Fantastic. I thought you
were. I love him. Sexy.
And a lot of Schubert's chamber works, piano and violin sonatas.
Yes, also, I don't listen to opera or symphonic music very much on the whole. Some chamber music, some... I sort of to go back to my nostalgia of my days at Cambridge, I sometimes listen to, as it were, Elizabethan church music and things like that. And I love Glenn Gould playing Bach. I have to say that is something that constantly astonishes and refreshes me.
It's time to open the floor for some Q&A right here.
You might be able to explain why this opera hasn't gotten the same playing so many years before.
I'll tell you one very good reason is it's extremely difficult to cast. And with all deference, I have to say I think it would be hard to find a better cast for this opera than we have right now. But these are roles that at any given time, but to get this kind of stellar group of people together is takes a lot of maneuvering.
Mr. Curran has to race to the airport, but can answer one question if someone has something specifically for him. Yes?
No. Yes.
Yes.
Well, the question, why is Barak the only one with a name? Because Barak's the center of the opera. Barak is the human soul and beating heart of the whole opera. Mm-hmm. Without Barak, there is no relation. Nobody has any relationship to anybody, because Barak is eventually the seed that you need to plant to make the babies. As to the second one, there are parallels with the Magic Flute, but there are parallels with dozens of operas and stories that are trial-type operas and magical-type operas. But as you say, the trials in this opera are for two women. And I think the whole point for me about this opera is it goes back to what the first question was, why did he write so well for women? Strauss was writing at the end of a wave of Freud and Jung. It was an enormous wave that took over Europe in about 50, 60 years. They are the end of the 19th century writers, if you think of Chekhov, Ibsen, Strindberg, etc. These men somehow were writing women's stories. They were getting into women's heads. In the 1940s, you had the same thing in Hollywood, where you had Billy Wilder, who was the greatest women's writer ever, because he got into women's heads. It's all your sort of post-Freudian, Jungian thing, I think, that really started to flourish in this particular piece, more so, I think, than many of his others. So if that answers in any way the question, yeah, go. And she says, no, shut up, you don't care, let's go. Then the nurse says, ah, you want to go to the world of smelly, vile, disgusting people? And she says, ah, no, I just want the shadow. No, you need to go to the world of smelly, vile, disgusting. Well, maybe if we could just skip that bit. And I think what it came into was this whole thing of, I mean, I am not saying for a second that Miss Paris Hilton had a crisis of conscience and all of a sudden thought, you know what? No, please. But I do feel the Kaiser and does. So there is a certain similarity with it.
I want to thank this phenomenal panel. It's been thrilling.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.